It's the Security Weekly News, episode number 300. How about that? I'm Doug White, and it is the week of 21 May, 2023. We got Space, the Final Frontier, Naughty Cell Phones, HP, Asus, Meta, Google, Gil Kirkpatrick, and more on this edition of the Security Weekly News.
This is a Security Weekly production for security professionals by security professionals. Please visit securityweekly.com/subscribe to subscribe to all the shows on our network.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
It's the show that keeps you up to date on the latest security news twice a week. Your trusted source for accurate security information and expert analysis. It's time for Security Weekly News.
Did you know that Active Directory is exploited in 9 out of 10 cyber attacks? With access to Active Directory, attackers can gain control of your network. To keep attackers out, you need to find and fix Active Directory security gaps. Meet Purple Knight, a free security assessment tool that scans your environment for hundreds of vulnerabilities and helps you fix the problems. Ready to reduce your Active Directory attack surface? Download Purple Knight, the number one Active Directory security vulnerability assessment tool. Visit securityweekly.com/Semperis, S-E-M-P-E-R-I-S, for more information.
Created in 2005 and hosted by security industry veterans, Paul Security Weekly is your source for in-depth coverage of the latest vulnerabilities, exploits, and security research. Our weekly security news discussion dives deep into the security issues we face today and potential solutions in a fun and lively atmosphere. Each week, we bring on guests from the security community to learn about their journey and discuss topics relevant to their work and research. You can also subscribe to our show by visiting securityweekly.com/subscribe or look for Paul Security Weekly in your favorite podcast catcher. We've recorded a ton of content over the years, so we created Spotify playlists featuring some of our favorite episodes, including interviews with Marcus Random, John McAfee, and Chris Roberts, to name a few. You can find them at securityweekly.com/starterpacks.
All right, welcome to the Security Weekly News. Can you believe we've done this 300 times? I mean, it's only 12C and hex, but I mean, it still sounds like a lot. Yeah, so can't believe it. All right. Well, Asus said in an apology that a server-side security maintenance error caused worldwide network connectivity loss in a wide range of their Soho routers. Wow. It must have been a surprise when everybody's like, hey, why is the internet stopped? But the problem started being reported on the 16th of May and had people saying that they had connectivity issues on Asus routers, and other people were complaining, of course, that they couldn't reach anyone at Asus. Why is it only ransomware companies have decent customer support? I mean, you call your ransomware provider, and I assure you they pick up the phone. But everybody else, it's just like a super challenge. It's like, we value you as a customer. Your average wait time is 9,642 minutes. But anyway, Asus is a manufacturer of hardware based in Taiwan, and they published a security bulletin today that said that the problem was introduced by an error in the config of a server settings file. They did not say specifically what kind of error occurred, nor did they indicate how it impacted the routers, but a Redditor said that the issues were caused by a corrupted definition file for ASD, which is the Asus AI protection engine. So this is probably one of those things, yeah, where the AI went like, I don't think so, Hal. But, you know, but Asus said that their team has addressed the server issues and all impacted routers should return to normal operations like now. But they also then immediately said, but it may be necessary to reboot your router, which is, of course, no big deal on Soho routers. Just make sure your comps are saved, I guess. But, you know, and that would fix it. But if that doesn't, they said it may be necessary to do a factory reset on some models. So, you know, I just kind of kept, you know, like, oh, no big deal. Oh, yeah, but you may need to. No. Anyway, in the same light, HP is working to resolve a firmware update that bricked HP office jets. How about that? So earlier this month, they put out a release and it started bricking all these printers. HP has not yet issued a public statement, but apparently they talked to Bleeping Computer, or somebody talked to Bleeping Computer, that said it was addressing a blue screen of death error seen by a, quote, limited number of users. Yeah, I always love those difficult decisions from the Pentagon. But, you know, anyway, thanks, Bill Burrows. But they said the issue was in the OfficeJet Pro 9020E printers, but then they had a list of a whole other bunch of printers as well. The error apparently pops up the good old blue screen of death. It's not the same one you're used to, but it's a blue screen of death. And The code is 83C000B. So if you see that on your printer, you've got it. You're infected. And you know, anyway, HP customers were advised to disable their printer's internet connection, which may be a big deal to some people, and wait until HP releases a fix. So if you're using internet printing, well, okay. Samsung smartphone users have been warned by the vendor and CISA about a vulnerability being exploited. The vulnerability is a kernel pointer exposure, and its issues are related to the log files, and it can allow a privileged local attacker, which that immediately kind of put me off. But, you know, I mean, I was like, once it has to be a privileged local attacker, it's like, is it like somebody grabs your phone out of your hand or something? But the privileged local attacker could bypass the ASLR exploit mitigation techniques, and it's being chained with other vulnerabilities, apparently. So it sounds like a pretty complicated attack, really. Because they have to get your phone, have local privilege, and then chain this with other vulnerabilities. But, you know, nevertheless, Samsung did patch this flaw with the May 2023 security update and said the flaw was disclosed in mid-January. It affects Android 11, 12, and 13 devices. So if you have one of those, you probably should patch it up. CISA did add the problem to the KEV on Friday. And they instructed government agencies, which is why I brought the story up, they instructed government agencies to patch this by the 9th of June. So if you are one of those, Google Tag got the credit for the discovery of the bug. So, you know, patch it. And in the same light, Apple released a security update last Thursday that patched dozens of vulnerabilities in iPhones and Macs, and it included 3 zero-day vulnerabilities that were affecting the WebKit browser engine. Two of those three were reported by an anonymous researcher, according to the report. The exploitation of those two can lead to sensitive information disclosure and arbitrary code execution. Always a fun thing. And apparently, though, again, so to fall back a little bit, these things often start out sounding like, uh-oh, I better, you know, put my phone in a paint can, although it doesn't help much with modern iPhone. But basically, the attacker still has to trick the user into processing some specially crafted WBE content, web content. But basically, that always immediately says, well, yeah, somebody will fall for that, but it's not as bad as if they can just do this kind of stuff without any kind of contact. Part of this involves luring the user to a malicious site. So as we'll see in our and Gil's story later, that whole smishing stuff is very, very prevalent. I got at least 3 smishing messages this morning already. Apple said that the vulnerabilities were patched with a rapid security response update, which is the first time they've ever done that. It was a new thing that they're doing. Google Tag reported the other 0 day along with Amnesty International. And that third vulnerability then likely has been exploited by commercial spyware vendors, because usually if Amnesty International is filing, it means that somebody's putting, you know, something on people's phones to track them or whatever. And so they didn't say that specifically, but that would be the implication there. So pretty much everyone, whatever kind of phone you have, it's probably a good week to patch, I think. Yeah. Well, Dish... So Dish, if you're not familiar with it, is they make those little satellite dishes you see on people's balconies all over the, you know, when you're driving down Riverside Drive or something, and you see a little, yeah, those are Dish satellites. They have begun notifying individuals about a data breach and ransomware attack that affected customers earlier. The company advised the Maine Attorney General, I don't know if that's where they're based or they just chose that one because, you know, it's like Portland's pretty nice or Augusta's pretty nice at this time of year. I don't know. But they advised the Maine Attorney General about this breach last week, and they shared a copy of the notification letter. Dish said that the incident impacted more than 296,000 individuals. They said that they currently had no evidence that the customer databases were being accessed and that the stolen data did not include employee-related records and personal information, but it did include former employees and their family members. Well, I don't know why they had information about employees' family members, but apparently they did. Dish found out about the incident in late February when various services they provide, including their website and apps, became inaccessible. Yeah, that's usually your big tip that something's going on. When it's just like, I know when I get those calls and they're like, my website is down. I'm like, yeah, it's not us. It's probably Sunspots. But then I immediately go check. They did confirm then that there was a ransomware attack and that as a part of that attack, data may have been stolen, which is pretty typical of modern ransomware attacks. The letter says They are not aware currently of any misuse of the personal information that the attackers provide, and that the attackers had provided them confirmation that the stolen data had been deleted. I don't know how you provide confirmation of that. It's kind of like, yeah, I deleted it. No, here's a picture of me deleting it. It's absolutely deleted. No way I did not delete that, because I just hit the delete button, so it must be deleted. But it would suggest, of course, that they paid a ransom. So this is the standard approach. As you pay us, we delete your data. We don't release it, you know, on the dark web. But Dish is offering the ubiquitous credit monitoring service booby prize that you get to anyone who's impacted. And like I always say, I think I have accumulated like four or five lifetimes worth of, credit monitoring service stuff from all the times I've been compromised. But they did say they were going to monitor the dark web to ensure that the stolen data is not, the deleted stolen data is not out there on the dark web. So yeah, I really felt much better at that point. Well, the EU, the European Union, hit Meta, the Facebook parent company, with a record fine on Monday after finding that Facebook broke EU privacy laws by transferring EU citizens' data back to the United States. Yep. I don't think any of us would be surprised by that. The penalty was pretty big, actually. It was $1.3 billion, and it didn't say if it was dollars or euros, but they're not exactly the same, but they're getting closer. But it was $1.3 billion, which was the largest fine ever issued so far by the European Union, I guess. The Irish Data Protection Commission ordered Meta to suspend all transfers of personal data belonging to users in the EU and the EEA, which is the European Economic Area. So the EEA includes some additional countries like Iceland, Liechtenstein, Norway, who are not members of the EU, but they participate. There's a whole bunch of, these are all these trade agreements and whatnot. But they said you can no longer send this data back to the United States, where we have pretty much no privacy rights at all, which, you can imagine that Meta is collecting everything they can and probably recording this conversation right now. And a couple of guys are going to come by and say, Zuck says hello as they beat me with lead saps. But as ever, there's been a long running court battle about privacy and such in the EU. And of course, as the United States doesn't have much of privacy protection, they sort of transfer it back. So in professional terms, it's complicated. I mean, there's apparently a deal on the way that has been a preliminary stages between U.S. President Joe Biden and the EU that they agreed to in March of 2022, but they've still not actually put it in place. This was supposedly going to put added checks around the collection of European personal information by U.S. intel agencies. So the whole controversy here is that Meta is bringing information back to the United States, which then does not have the privacy protections that people are guaranteed in the EU, which is very strict. The GDPR is very, very strict about this stuff and about what can be given to the police and what can be given to intelligence agencies and so forth. But the US doesn't have those protections. So, you pull them back here. It's kind of like those black torture sites they used to have, where they say, yeah, it's illegal in the US, but we can ship you off to somewhere in Uyghurstan and who knows what might happen. They're trying to make this deal final, but it hasn't been there yet. Transborder data flow has always been an issue, but it used to be an issue involving pieces of paper. Now, most large companies have presences around the world and they have stuff in the cloud. So your cloud may be spread across many, many countries. So a lot of that old sovereignty stuff where, our border is defined by the river. That stuff's really complicated now. And, the cloud just makes it all worse. So basically this article says, though, that the senior VP for International Regulatory Affairs and Antitrust at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce said that because this is affecting U.S. business, the time has come for the U.S. and the EU to operationalize this agreement very quickly, which would return certainty to data flows that underpin the transatlantic economic ties, society, and international cooperation between the EU and the United States. The fine isn't a record for Meta, though. They actually had to pay a $5 billion settlement with the Federal Trade Commission in 2019 over, guess what, mishandling of user data. That should pretty much tell you that your personal information is incredibly valuable, and the likelihood that they're going to stop collecting it is about nil, regardless of the fines. I pay speeding ticket fines all the time. They're just, they're not high enough. Well, Gil Kirkpatrick is the chief architect at Semperis. Gil is a long-term member of the commercial software industry and has focused on identity and access management products since the early 1990s. Welcome, Gil. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Doug. Thanks. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. You know, I mean, one of the things that I always felt good about, I think, historically, was my VM environment. You know, I always just had this, and I know it's naive. I mean, I felt like, you know, these things, it's going to be hard to hack this system. It's going to be hard to break this system. There's all these layers in it and so forth. But, you know, I mean, today we're seeing it all move into the cloud. That makes me more nervous. I mean, so this story that you sent that you want to talk about is about Microsoft Azure, which is Microsoft's hypervisor, if you're not familiar with it, but you probably are. And apparently it was having some VMs being hijacked in their cloud space. So I maybe you could just give us a rundown on what this article is about.
Yeah, it was the reason I picked this article is it highlighted a feature in Azure AD VMs that I was just unaware of. If you've worked in data centers before, you've heard of ILO cards, right? Like HP had this, what is it called? Something lights out card, which would give you access to the boot environment and some of the hardware features of HP servers, even though the OS wasn't running. And apparently the virtual ROMs that Azure VMs use have the same sort of capability. So you can actually get a serial port, a virtualized serial port access to Azure VMs. It's something I was just utterly unaware of, and I thought that was really kind of cool. This particular attack actually wasn't a compromise of the VM per se. It was a smishing attack the attackers were able to get privileged admin accounts. I think they actually, in this particular case, got global admin access to the Azure AD tenant. But what it did let them do is once they established this sort of virtual serial port connection, they were able to manipulate the virtual machines and avoid a lot of the logging that would normally occur, because it's this virtual serial port connection to the VM is happening outside of the context of the operating system. So the normal logging features and things like that that you would have in your VM don't apply. So I thought that was kind of interesting. It wasn't a new vulnerability per se. It was a new way to access the virtual machine and make it harder to detect.
So this is kind of a new old attack, really, in a way. I mean, because we used to see attacks on the mainframe and things that came in through stuff like our logins and finger attacks and things like that were using these sort of lower level type problems and getting in through those ports. And, you know, and people were saying, I can't believe my mainframe got attacked because all these shells are all locked down and whatever, but they were coming into that. So this is like a baseboarding type attack.
Yeah, it's that sort of a thing, except it's all virtualized, of course, and it's in the cloud. So it even, you know, it avoids things like, well, anything that's running in the OS is not part of the equation. So even if you've got all your ports firewalled off in your Windows or Linux VM, you still have this virtual serial port access to the VM itself. So I thought that was kind of cool. And this particular group that they associated with the attack is called UNC 3944. I have no idea who they are or what they really do. But Mandiant indicated that they were primarily financially motivated, and what they do is exfiltrate data and then sell it or hold it for ransom. So, you know, it's like you said, it's a new old attack. Vulnerabilities, just rehashes of the old ones.
And I think just like some of those old mainframe attacks, I know that when I was managing mainframe, you know, there was a real problem with logging below the shell level. And it's the same exact problem because virtual machines are a lot like mainframe type scenarios. And so the logging that occurred at the system level did occur if you wanted to take the time to look at it, but it's a lot of stuff to manage, you know, at the system level. And so a lot of people are monitoring VMs within VM equipment. I mean, was that a fair assessment?
Like I said, this was a completely new capability to me for the VMs, and I'm sure that most people are not looking at their boot diagnostics log to see any access through the this virtual serial port. So it's just another place that you're going to have to check periodically.
Yep. I mean, I went and looked. I mean, I actually was thinking about after I read the story you sent me, and I was like, I'm going to go check that on mine because I know those logs are there, and I've looked at them before when problems were occurring. So I had actually gone to the console and logged in, you know, through a direct console into ESXi. And got in there and was looking at those sort of Linux-esque kind of logs, but I didn't really have any kind of parsing tools or anything to do it. So it was very manual. I was literally scrolling through unbelievable amounts of stuff trying to figure out what's throwing errors and where they're coming from because they weren't being generated by VMs.
Right. The other thing that was surprising to me is that this is all this virtual serial ports enabled by default for all of the Linux VMs, and I think also for the more recent platform Windows VMs. So it's not like it's something you have to go explicitly turn on and then start monitoring. It's on by default, so you really have to take a look at it. Go and explicitly turn it off.
That seems very strange to me. I mean, because so few things actually use serial connections, except Cisco, where we have virtual serial ports all the time, but. I mean, I haven't really used a serial connection. You know, I set one up on a VM. So now that I think about it, it was there because I was setting up COM ports, you know, so I had all these COM ports. And one of the things I was building was a backdoor into my ESXi stack because I wanted to be able to get into it when everything else failed. So if my firewall failed and all this stuff. And the way I built that was using a dial-up modem. So I had a literal, it's old school, but there was there was a server room. There's an old, handset telephone sitting there on the floor. And I was like, nobody's using that. I don't even know but it had a dial tone. So I literally took that, plugged it into a virtual USB modem and fed that into the COM port so I could get into my management environment, even if my firewall was shut down, even if the power was out, as long as the telephone wire still worked, I had a kind of backdoor. And I did that because I kept locking myself out. I went with my firewall. I would accidentally if I didn't put a rule at the very top, my firewall let myself in. So now this thing though did, there's two things here I wanted to talk about a little bit. One is this baseboarding attack in general. So one thing people need to do is they need to make sure that their baseboard administrative management network VLAN, and you have one of those, right? Is not open to the internet. Is that a fair statement?
I think that's a fair statement, although with everybody working from home, that might not be practical. And again, this particular misuse required existing admin credentials to have already been compromised, right? So it wasn't a new exposure of credentials. And this particular attacker used SMS. They were able to, I think, phish the help desk to get a password reset to get access to the Azure Global Admin credentials. So one of the things I took away from it is please get rid of SMS as a second factor. It's such a piece of crap from a security point of view. You know, use FIDO or use Authenticator or something like that. And go ahead and disable boot diagnostics because I can't imagine that you really need that unless there's something truly broken about your virtual environment. I think if you put those two things in place, this becomes much less of an issue.
I mean, it's
because you explicitly have to turn on the serial port to take advantage of it.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you about people working from home, but I have this just general aversion to allowing people to access my management VLAN, you know, and these services. And I know we all went through it because even though I manage a very small number of users on virtual machines, I still, when the pandemic started, you know, we got told at the university, you have till tomorrow to make plans because as of tomorrow, you will no longer be allowed physically in any building on campus. And I immediately contacted them and said, so what about my server room? Can I still go in there? And they said, no. And I said, but there's nobody in there. It's like a dark room with just me. I mean, like, I literally open one door and go in another door, and then I'm like totally cut off from the world. I always make sure my cell phone works in case something falls on me and I'm laying in there. I don't want to have to like gnaw my own leg off or something. And I really, you know, I was still told, no, you're not going to be allowed to come in any building on campus. The police will respond if a door opens. And I'm like,
what, even with a mask? Are you kidding me? Come on.
This is early days of the pandemic. They said the campus is closed, that no one is allowed in the buildings for any reason whatsoever, including emergencies. And I was like, what? But I immediately started setting about how am I going to get to these resources from home that, you know, I'm not going to be able to, and I had that modem, so I felt better about it. But I do see why people did this, because they were told so quickly, all your techs are going home, but they're going to need to be able to access resources. And they opened up this kind of baseboarding stuff and management and put all these VLANs on the internet. So I completely agree with you about not using SMS, because, so my second question was, this did involve smishing. And of course, if smishing is not there, then phishing works too, because even if you're using something besides SMS, I may be able to still get you to give me that code. I mean, we've seen attacks like that over and over again. I get that right person and they give it all up and it's just over. Is there anything we can do?
It all starts in the identity platform, and it's, you know, 80, 90% of the attacks start with some sort of credential compromise. So,
I mean, what is the best way
to get control over?
What is the best way to stop this then? I mean, I've been doing those kind of attacks, white hat only. I've been doing those kind of attacks since that 1980s, and they worked then. I've got documented ones I succeeded with in 1986. We've done it in the 90s. We've done it in the 2000s. We're still doing it today, because I can just call and call and call until I get that one person who's just feeling helpful today.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the FIDO approach, you know, getting rid of passwords in general so you don't have passwords to reset, I think is the best thing we've got right now. And more platforms are moving over to 2FA and passwordless kinds of authentication using FIDO too. I think that's, you know, for me, that's the next future level.
I mean, I've been fighting with companies about identity management like that since forever, because we were auditing people and going, and they go, oh, there's one password. It's used on every device. I literally remember going to a company that was a multinational. I mean, they had literally operations on every continent except Antarctica and including, you know, islands and all these things. And they had something like 31 like mainframe tech people, and they had one password that they shared, and that was the root password, and everybody knew it, including people that were dead, retired, fired, etc., because they never changed it, because it was going to be a disaster. And I completely agree with that. Getting rid of the password is just so important, and you need that track. You know, one of my big audit things was, you need to know who it is. I want to know who that person is that accessed the system. And in the old days, we had to sign. You know, I had a government computer that if I logged into that computer, even though I was completely legitimate user, when I logged in, I still had to put on the tear sheet. I had to write down who I was, when I logged in, and why I logged in every single time.
Yeah. And sort of the modern equivalent of that is privileged account management, right? You actually disable your privileged accounts until someone really needs to use it, and then you go through some sort of a workflow to check out that account, get an approval, use it for a limited amount of time, and then disable it again. You know, that's a pretty good approach.
I had that on a DEC 10. I had a script, and if someone tried to log into any of the privileged accounts, the script intercepted it. So it was actually a parsing script that intercepted what people typed for username. If somebody tried to type one of those accounts, it immediately locked them out and lit up my screen. And I was like, okay, I got to go check on this. Why did somebody on terminal 6004 try to access this privileged account? And I really was worried about that way back in the early 80s. I mean, I was thinking, that was probably like 82. You know, I was thinking about how bad that was. So I think it's going to continue to be a problem as long as we have humans, and as long as humans can call other humans, you're going to have that kind of attack.
I am in total agreement with you. It's going to be a problem for a long time.
All right. Thank you, Gil, for joining us. It was a pleasure to talk about this.
You bet. Thanks, Doug. I appreciate it.
All right. We'll see you again soon. And finally, SpaceX sent more private astronauts into space with a mission to the International Space Station on a charter flight. Wow. This marked the second group of private citizens who flew with Axiom Space, who's chartering rockets from SpaceX, and they send people up to the space station. The group arrived on Monday for an 8-day stay. It was not announced how much each one of those people paid for this flight, but the previous mission Axiom did charged as much as $55 million for each person. So it's kind of like Uber Black at rush hour in New York. But if you want to, sponsor me, any of you out there who just sold your company, you know, for the billions and all that with a B, I would really like to go. I can report in, tell you what it's like. You know, the first class accommodations are going to be up to your standards or not. I can send you my contact information. I'll be at the Green Cities Conference in Augsburg, Germany on the 20th to 24th of June. If you're going to be in the vicinity, you can drop by. That's the news. Thanks, Gil Kirkpatrick and Semperis, and I will see you on Friday.